I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me on this February 12th, 2013. It's a beautiful day here in Manhattan, and I'm so glad you're joining me today. It's going to be a great program because my first guest, I want to get right to it. It's one of my very favorite people on the whole planet and the best doctor that I know. Dr. Joel Fuhrman is a board-certified family physician and nutritional researcher who specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. He is the author of several books, including the New York Times bestsellers Eat to Live, The Amazing Nutrient-Rich Program for Fat, Fast and Sustained Weight Loss, and Superimmunity. He's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and research director of the Nutritional Research Foundation, and he's also on the Science Advisory Board of Whole Foods Market. Dr. Fuhrman, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, great to be here.
Hi, you know, I know you're busy doing so many wonderful things and saving so many lives and helping so many people, and I'm really grateful to have you here for this moment.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. Read this book. I've read all your books. I'm a big fan, and I read a lot of these health books, and yours are clearly the best on so many levels. And I'm so glad that you've been on the bestseller list of New York Times. What Is It Eat to Live is there for over 80 weeks now, and now you have this second book, The End of Diabetes. A well-deserved congratulations to you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really exciting. The book's been out, I think, only about a month or so, and it's already on the New York Times bestseller list. So people are really utilizing it. They're eating it up, right.
Okay, I have a lot of questions, and I posted to my listeners and readers that you were going to be on the show today, and I got some responses, so I'm hoping we can address some of the questions.
Sure.
Okay. So lots of really interesting things in this book that I didn't know about. And I want to start by talking about beta cells, because that's so related to diabetes and why people have the reactions that they do. So can we talk a little bit about beta cells, how genetics are involved, and how eating affects them?
Of course. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, so what I read, I understand that some people have less beta cells genetically?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, we're talking here now, right now, about adult onset or type 2 diabetes,
right,
which is mostly caused by people becoming overweight, and the extra stress being overweight places on the pancreas. So the main thing is that fat on the body blocks the uptake of insulin. And because your body can't utilize the insulin, the uptake is blocked, the beta cells in the pancreas then respond to that by producing extra insulin. So they produce, you know, maybe you have 10 pounds of extra body weight, and your body's producing 1.5 times as much insulin as a person of normal weight. Or you have 30 or 40 pounds of extra body weight, and your body's producing 4 to 5 times as much insulin. And the beta cells in the pancreas keep chugging along and making that insulin the body needs. Except for after a number of years, the beta cells kind of poop out and can't keep up with the huge demand required by this overweight person, and their ability to produce insulin starts to drop. Now, that amount of insulin, even after it drops, is still greater, almost all the time, usually greater than a person of normal weight might need, but it's not enough to produce the excessive demands of the overweight body. Now, like you were suggesting, that some people who are overweight can keep secreting abnormally high amounts of insulin throughout their whole life and never become diabetic, and other people, their beta cell reserve and the capacity of the beta cells to produce so much insulin genetically is somewhat limited, and they are more prone to developing type 2 diabetes. And so, in all cases, being overweight, all overweight people have more circulating insulin, and their beta cells are being overworked to produce more insulin. And insulin itself promotes cancer. Insulin itself is a fat storage hormone and has pro-angiogenesis properties, which means, fat, go ahead and grow, cells reproduce, I'm going to feed you with fuel and bring oxygen nutrients to you, and my angiogenesis promoting effects are going to help the blood vessels grow into you to be networks, the travel networks, the roadway to bring you food and oxygen. So that's what insulin does. And when you are overweight, you're essentially fueling fat. And the more glucose you eat, the more sugar you eat, the more insulin-promoting foods you eat up, obviously, the more, like, you know, you put sugar in your bloodstream all the time, it's going to promote the storage of fat.
So whether or not you're diabetic, if you're overweight, you're producing too much insulin, and that's going to have all kinds of health problems. Not necessarily diabetes, perhaps, but you could have all kinds of other problems. It's not a good thing.
That's right. So that's one of the main reasons being overweight is increases your risk of heart attack and cancer is because our body has higher levels of circulating insulin. And a one way to measure the body's weight, the level of circulating insulin is waist, is a tape measure around your waist.
You know? Don't need a sophisticated diagnostic tool for that.
Correct.
Okay. It's always good to have a little humor when we're talking about these things. You have a great little graph in your book. It is so simple. And when I saw it and understood it, I went, wow. Can we talk about glycolysis, what it is, and how important it is?
Well, yes. I mean, what happens is that the body takes the glucose in the bloodstream, and we use that for energy to live and to, you know, and to live our life. But the body only burns about 40, 50 grams of glucose per hour. What happens when we eat a meal and we flood the body with, you know, with all these calories, with 300, you know, with, the point is that the body stores it. So with the glucose that we're not burning, the body stores, and it's primarily stored in the body as glycogen. And now, when we're not eating, you know, and we're not digesting food anymore for 3, 4, 5, you know, hours later, like the candle burns down the wax, like the wick of a candle burns down the wax, we're going to slowly fuel off that, fuel our body off the glycogen, and the glycogen stores are going to be gradually depleted, like we're burning the gasoline in our car, driving a car around. Mm-hmm. So we're going to store the glucose as glycogen, and then we're going to burn it off. And when the glycogen is eventually depleted, then we should normally get a signal to eat again. And that's time to replenish our glycogen stores to keep our glucose levels, to keep our glucose cells consistently generated so our brain, the rest of our body, can function normally. And basically, 80% of our body's energy needs at rest is being utilized by the brain, and the brain under normal conditions can only function on glucose, so we have to keep that glucose coming in continually to fuel the brain.
But what you said is during this period of glycolysis, after the body has gotten the glucose it needs and we have this period in between meals, there's a lot of things that are going on. The body's removing waste. And you mentioned that if we eat too quickly, if we eat by snacking or just eat all the time, we don't give our body enough time to go through this period so that it can remove waste. I thought that was fascinating. I never knew that.
That's right. So we're saying that glycolysis is normal, it's necessary, and it's essential for the body's systems and rhythms. The body works in cycles of, you know, resting, resting and cleaning, digesting and storing thing, you know, over and over again. And we call it the catabolic phase or the breakdown phase. So we eat, and we're in a build-up phase, and we're going to break down, to the food we eat and utilize it and store it away on our body as fat or as glycogen. And then we're going to burn, then we're going to not eat, and we're going to live off what we just stored. And that phase is called the catabolic phase of the digestive cycle. We're burning up what we just stored. It's like you took your car to the gas station, you filled it with gas. And then you're going to drive it around pretty much and empty the tank, and you're going to refill it again. But what most Americans are doing, they take the car from the gas station, and they drive it around just one block. And a 20-gallon tank, they drive around one block, and they bring it back to the gas station to fill it up again. And they fill it up again. The gas tank is not elastic. You're going to pour gasoline all over the street. But in the case of the human body, we do have an elastic gas tank. We could fill it up again when there's no need for energy, and the body will store the extra energy it doesn't need now as fat on the body and getting bigger and bigger. And what I'm saying, two things here. Number one, that the body has signals that tell us exactly when we should refill our gas tank up and we burn off, and those signals supply us and our body and our brain with a perfect amount of energy we need to sustain and maintain a perfect normal weight, the weight that leads to a lean body mass, maximizing muscle intake with no fat storage on the body. That's called true hunger. True hunger exists as a precise computer to direct us to the exact amount of calories we need to maintain our perfect body weight, but not gaining any fat on our body. True hunger could never be there to put fat. If you became overweight, here's the point. you had to have been eating outside of the demands of true hunger, recreationally, with addictive drives, toxic hunger, what I call it, due to a low-nutrient diet, driving you to eat when you're not hungry, when you're feeling shaky and weak and headachy and fatigued, and you think it's time to eat and you think you're hungry. It's because your dietary quality is poor, and now you feel detox symptoms or withdrawal due to your poor diet, driving you to eat excess calories. And lastly, the point you were just making earlier, that I'm suggesting that the scientific literature points to the fact that the longer we live in the catabolic phase of the digestive cycle, the longer we live. Let me say that in normal terms, so people understand what I'm saying here.
You have to do that, yep.
So what I'm saying here is, the longer we live our life in the phase of the digestive cycle when we're not digesting and eating, that means living space between meals where we're working and talking and walking and, you know, living the life when we're not putting food in our mouth. It's the longer we live without continually eating, the longer space we have between meals, the longer we don't feed our body, the longer we live, because the body is essentially, because almost all healing and self-repair and rejuvenation of tissue is occurring in that catabolic phase when you're not digesting food. And because the dietary quality, or we could say the micronutrient intake of most Americans is so poor and so deficient in phytonutrients and antioxidants, that they feel so ill the minute they start to detoxify or repair that they have to keep feeding the body all the time. So they're snacking all day, going from one meal to the next without any catabolic phase, and even eating late at night, or eating big meals with concentrated calories so difficult to digest that they keep the body's digestive tract going for 3 and 4 and 5 hours after meal. Your body's still digesting. They never give the body a rest. Thus, they develop heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and all these diseases. Way overeating. So I'm suggesting that the primary foundation of all these difficulties is micronutrient deficits and poor quality food, eating processed foods and bagels and donuts and cookies and crackers and soda and bread and oils and meats and all these, and cheese, all these foods that do not contain the micronutrient load, the antioxidants, the phytochemicals, all these thousands of nutrients we know are in nature's kingdom that the human body and other primates thrive on. When you don't eat them, you're going to get unrelenting desires and cravings to overeat, even perverted cravings to overeat food, laying the foundation of the American heart attack and diabetes and obesity epidemic.
You know, you give this analogy with cars and fuel. Now, unfortunately, I do know some people who like to fill up the car very frequently because they're really nervous about running out of gas. But I think a lot of people treat their cars better than they do their own bodies. They buy the high-octane, more expensive fuels, and they don't think about quality fuel for their own body. It's a great analogy, people's cars and their own bodies.
That's right. I guess you can, in life you can get another car if you hurt it in some way. But you only get one body.
One body.
And once you've damaged it, that's it. It's still yours you're right. It's utterly amazing how people are, and we're talking here about most people being completely oblivious to what they do young in life, and they pay the price for it later in life. My daughter was just talking to me about the fact, we were just having a conversation about what you do when you're young. You can, whether it's school, education, whether it's putting, taking care of your health, savings, or just, let's say, having posture we're talking about, doing things in athletic careers or doing things to hurt your joints when you're young that you pay a price for, and you limp or you have knee pain when you're older. We're talking here about, preventative and doing things intelligently for your future that young people don't do. We think when we're young, we think we're vulnerable, we're invulnerable to anything, and we're going to, we're not thinking about that enough. And we have to really think about this for a minute, because we're not talking about just how long we're going to live. We're talking about living a life, a quality life, be able to enjoy our later years. That's right. Not being comfortable, not being in pain, having our full mental faculties intact, having our full vision intact. And, of course, that this is a really serious serious subject, and you know I'm on a mission to get this information out because,
yes.
you know, diabetes is the leading cause of blindness, the leading cause of leg amputation, the leading cause of kidney failure. We're talking here not just about, you know, $500 billion a year in needless health care costs. We're talking about human suffering that is needless, that doesn't have to be. And now nutritional science has advanced to the point where we have a preponderance of evidence that you don't have to have diabetes.
It's just amazing.
And the medications, you know, let's just say this one thing is really important. That people take medications thinking they're controlled. I'll get all these emails and say, oh, I have controlled high blood pressure. My diabetes is controlled. Controlled, that means you're on medication and you still have it. Because the studies show you're still going to develop macular degeneration and all these problems. If it's controlled, you got to get rid of it. You got to show me you have normal numbers without medication. You have to have normal blood pressure without the need for blood pressure medication. You have to have a normal blood glucose without the need for diabetic medication. Then you're protected. Then you're not going to have the heart attack, not going to have the stroke, not going to get demented, not going to have to go blind later in life. The more you need medications, the more dependent you are on, that means the more tendency you have and more damage that's occurring to your body ongoing. You know, the medications give people a false sense of security
yeah.
that they're protected, and they lead people to down the wrong path. You know, it's so true with diabetic medication. And you know, Karen, you might be familiar with the ACCORD study, where they took diabetics and they gave them better medical care, more attention to their
mm-hmm.
glucose, and doctors took, you know, they had two groups, and one group were the typical group, which, you know, didn't go to doctors as often, forgot to take their medications, weren't medicated as carefully, but the other group had really top-flight medical care, the best doctors, more visits, and the group that had more medical care to control their glucose better with the better use of medications were dropping off like flies. They were dying at such an increased
That's
rate
so
of death
sad. Yeah.
that the government had to stop the study and say, stop, halt, can't call them this study. You know, and then doctors saying, what is this, more medical care, better medical? Well, of course, you know, we're covering up, you know, you can't push the glucose down with a drug. You have the beta cells in the pancreas just talked about are failing, overworked. Now, when you give drugs, going to make you gain weight, going to make you push the pancreas to work harder, take insulin to make you put more fat on the body, to put the sugars down, that's going to accelerate the degenerative process. The point is there's no other there's nothing else you can do except eat right and exercise and get in great shape and take great care of your health, because drugs are not the answer to what ails us, and the medical profession doesn't have the magic pill like some fairy tale that's going to make us all take care of all our problems. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, you even write in your book that some insulin and other medications make diabetes work. It makes you want to eat more and aggravate the situation even more.
That's right, because they take the lower your blood glucose, they help you, they're angiogenesis promoting, they help the body store fat, they make you, and they increase your hunger, they lead to weight gain, you become more diabetic, and you're back to the doctors getting more medication again. It's just, it's absolutely insane. You know, we're talking here about, you know, of course this book, The End of Diabetes, you think, well, how many people have diabetes, you know? But, you know, but about 40% of our population presently either has pre-diabetes or diabetes, and about 70, 80% are overweight. But besides that, we're talking here about reversing high blood pressure, reversing heart disease, getting back into fit and great shape again. We're talking about people who are willing to take toxic medications in their mouth twice a day, but they're not willing to walk up a few flights of stairs twice a day. They're not willing to, you know, take a walk for 20 minutes twice a day. They're not willing to. The point is that exercise has been shown over and over again to be much more efficacious than taking drugs. And, you know, I say to people, you know, how often do you take that drug? Do you take it every day? Twice a day even? They go, yeah, I take it twice a day. That's what my doctor prescribed it. I go, you take that twice a day? You know, they look at me like I'm nuts. What am I saying twice a day? What am I saying? And the point I'm saying, well, why would you take a drug twice a day, but you won't exercise twice a day? Do you exercise twice a day? You exercise two or three times a week.
That's too difficult.
Yeah, that we want to. So the point is, we never had these medications. People would be forced to change the way they eat. They'd be forced to exercise regularly, and we'd have a population. We'd have a population without diabetes, without these diseases of nutritional stupidity. But you know, and on the other hand, you know, that unhealthy food is so powerfully addicting. It takes over the mind in a way that people can't rationally think and act and behave and control themselves, because they've become food addicts, every bit as powerful as cocaine and heroin and tobacco. And, you know, so food is very addicting. But here's the thing, and we people, they'll, you know, they'll, and most diabetologists will say to me, "Oh yeah, yeah, I know that works, but we can't get our patients to do that." And you know, and the American Diabetic Association says, you know, diet. The reason we have to give everybody drugs is because people won't eat. Essentially, it's double talk for saying, you know, our diets we're giving people don't work. You know, but the point is that eating a high nutrient diet, your taste buds change, your appetite goes down. We can beat food cravings and food addictions, but we have to teach people how to do this with a higher intake of high nutrient food, not by willy-nilly just cutting back calories and trying to eat less. That never works, and our taste buds can be retrained, and the body can learn to like healthy food just as much as it liked unhealthy food. It's called a no-brainer.
Right. We like this food more. I love my food. And you don't know how good you can feel until you're feeding your body properly.
That's right. You like the food more, and then intellectually, you also know, as you're enjoying eating, you're enjoying even more because not only emotionally, but intellectually, you know what's good for you at the same time.
Can we talk about resistant starch? So I was reading about this in your book, and I just loved what I was reading and what we're discovering about resistant starch. It's almost like you can eat things and you think you're getting so many calories, but you're not.
Yeah, I think that's really fun. You know, I think nutrition is really fun.
It's interesting
to learn about. You know, because the more we learn, the more it shows us why we should be eating certain foods and why they work and why. So we're talking now about why foods like greens and why beans, for example, and squash and eggplant and cauliflower, why these foods, for example, don't raise your glucose, don't make you gain weight, don't cause diabetes, as another carbohydrate like white rice or white bread or white potato may raise your glucose more. And the point is that one of the reasons why is because beans contain two types of carbohydrates, two types of starch predominantly. One is called slowly digestible starch, which means that when we eat the food, the glucose is broken down so slowly that it's fed into your body over many hours, which means if it's fed into the body slowly over many hours, the body can burn it for energy as it's being fed in and not store it as fat, or even as glycogen. And the second thing is a lot of the carbohydrate, a big percentage of the carbohydrate in beans is called resistant starch, which you just brought up, which is not even broken down into glucose or simple sugars at all. It's because resistant means it's resistant to the body's enzymes that can break it down, so it can't be broken down. Instead, it gets degraded, or we could say the bacteria in the digestive tract ferment it and turn it into fat, not even to carbohydrate. So the carbohydrate is turned into a fat, but because the bacteria turn it into this fat, mostly called butyrate, the fat, it gets turned into this fat so far down in the digestive tract that 90% of those calories remain in the stool and get passed down the toilet. So a percent of those calories in beans don't even get absorbed as calories into the body. It's like the difference between a walnut and walnut oil, or sesame seeds and sesame oil. When you eat the whole nut or seed, the fat calories get absorbed so slowly that it causes fatty acid oxidation. The body can burn it. When you eat the oil, it's absorbed in the bloodstream so rapidly it can't be stored, so the body produces hormones that convert it into fat. So when we take things and when we flood the body rapidly with nutrients, it's converted into fat, and we take it slowly over many hours, it's not converted into fat. It's not calories in, calories out, eat less and exercise more. That's not the thing here. It's we're talking about foods that have properties to resist fat storage, like mushrooms, like onions, like green vegetables, like beans, berries, pomegranates, beans. We're talking here that these foods have anti-angiogenesis effects, opposite to the sugar, where the sugar promotes fat storage, or the white rice promotes fat storage due to the high insulin effects, because the high insulin is a fat storage hormone, and insulin is pro-angiogenesis. And when you eat beans and greens and berries and seeds and things like that, they have anti-angiogenesis, which says, no way, Jose, you're not storing fat on my body. I'm blocking fat storage hormones. I'm going to stop the body from being able to store fat. I'm not going to allow blood vessels to grow and feed fat. Fat can't grow when you eat the right type of calories. So it's really not about eating thimble-sized portions of food here. It's about eating generous portions of food, but the right type of delicious foods that don't promote fat storage in the body.
You know, they call beans the magical fruit, but I'm not going to go there. We have a caller, and I want to see what she has to say. Lori, are you with us?
I have a question for Dr. Furman.
Okay.
I've been a vegan for 23 years. I exercise regularly. A few years ago, I was diagnosed with Graves' disease. I was desperate and took a radioactive iodine pill. I've been on Synthroid, which makes I feel fine with that. My TSH level is normal, but a couple years after, the Graves got into my eyes, and I have double vision that it can only be treated, I'm told, with wearing prisms, which is what I'm doing. I'm already doing the greens, the berries, everything you're talking about. Is there anything else you suggest I can do?
Well, yeah, the point you're making is that it's with Graves' disease, it's a disease that where antibodies attack the thyroid gland. And those antibodies have negative effects on the body and eyes and other parts of the body. So even when the thyroid gland is removed or, you know, treated with radiation so you don't have it anymore, your body still has the disease. It's not necessary. And so autoimmune diseases are treatable with nutritional excellence. It's not just so the answer is yes, and we could monitor the treatment, the benefits of this treatment style with nutrition by checking your antithyroglobulin antibodies and other markers of disease, the disease process, even though you don't have a thyroid gland anymore. So yes, I mean, so it's not just, so G-bombs are that you're suggesting G-bombs, they're the central core of the treatment of autoimmune disease, and G-bomb stands for
greens beans onions, mushrooms, berries.
And seeds, right? So we're talking here about that, and we also, some episodic days during the month where you either are juicing or just on water, where you're just doing some fasting, can lower your levels of antibodies, making sure your body weight is low, taking more omega-3 fatty acids can have beneficial effects, and some probiotics can have beneficial effects. So we're talking here about putting the proper diet style together. That's lowering calories and higher in nutrients, lower in calories, you know, with a high nutrient density, your diet with a high nutrient density, and making sure there's no nutritional deficiencies that exist simultaneously. Like, for example, vitamin D deficiency can be permissive to autoimmune disease. So I think the answer to the question is that let's get back to the basics of making sure you're doing everything right for superior nutrition to see if your body can fix the autoimmune process. And we can get, and most likely we can make tremendous progress with Graves' disease, because I've seen many, many cases of Graves' disease even reverse, who didn't need any treatment of having their thyroid, you know, radio ablation of the thyroid gland. They've just gotten completely better, and you can still do that at this point in your life.
Thank you, Dr. Furman. We have just a few more minutes left. Can we take one more call?
Sure.
Okay, Eric, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Karen and Dr. Furman. How are you?
Doing great.
All right. I had a couple questions. I'm working on nutritional excellence, and wanted to ask you what your opinion is about the 80-10-10. Did you get a chance to maybe look over that book, the 80-10-10 book?
Well, I think what you're referring to is a diet that has 10% fat, 10% protein, 80% carbohydrate. It's mostly a fruit-heavy diet. And I've been a physician.
And greens, and also a lot of greens, yes.
And also a lot of greens, right. And I've been a physician specializing in nutrition for more than 20 years, and I have seen many, many people ruin their health with a diet so high in fruit. So I don't consider that an ideal way to eat. And some people can do okay with it, but I don't think it's good to advocate a diet where a whole segment of the population develops, you know, doesn't thrive and, you know, gets weak hair and nails and prone to infection. And so I do not recommend that diet style or that book.
Okay. And I mean, I have all of your books and the DVDs also. So I'm mostly following the Nutritarian. I just was curious in that area. So I wanted to ask you about the berries and the fruits that we eat on the Nutritarian style, and I've listened to your seminar, the 10 DVD set.
Oh, really?
Yeah, wow. So I wanted to ask you, because you didn't cover the fact on the fruits, since they digest the quickest and the easiest, should we, first of all, since the oils and the nuts and seeds or whatnot, they slow down and don't allow the glucose to be utilized as per the process of diabetes, where that comes from, right? The fat blocks the glucose from being utilized properly. So I wanted to ask you, is it better to eat the fruits and the berries and whatnot first instead of last, which is has been, I guess, the traditional way of eating dessert, but it should be really maybe according to natural hygiene, where the fruits and the juices should be the easiest digestible stuff eaten first without combination to any oils or nuts and seeds or anything like that.
No, I don't appreciate the question, but I don't agree with that either. That I think that so I'm recommending here is a nutritarian diet. Thank you for supplying that term, which I, you know, obviously that's the style of nutritarian eating. It's high in nutrients. And I want people to eat a variety of foods in their diet. Green vegetables, beans, nuts and seeds, fresh fruit. Whereas the diet you were describing might have been too fruit heavy. I want a variety of those foods. And I want you to eat a variety of foods that eat at various meals. I don't want you to eat fruit only meals. I want you to have greens and beans or greens and nuts or, you know, you could have fruit in the meal. But we don't want to have a fruit only meal. And once that meal is mixed, where you have like some pomegranates on a salad or oranges cut into a salad with a nut-based dressing or a, you know, an orange cashew sesame seed dressing or a tomato strawberry, whatever, you know, I'd like people to mix the foods so that
so it's okay to mix the fruits and the
beans okay to mix
and all
the food
that stuff.
And actually what you're saying is that the other foods that have lower glycemic effects mitigate or lessen the glycemic effect of the fruit when eating the same meal. So that's the benefit is to eat the food actually together, to eat a fruit with a salad or eat beans with some nuts. And when you eat the foods together, the fats from the nuts and seeds increase the absorption of the anti-cancer phytochemicals in the green vegetables, lowering the risk of cancer later in life. One of the studies that are so impressive are the Seventh-day Adventist study that showed that those people eating nuts and seeds on a regular basis lived on the average 6 or 7 years longer than those people on a low-fat diet that didn't have nuts and seeds in their diet because the fat increases the absorption of the beneficial phytochemicals that prevent cancer. So what I'm saying is don't combine your, forget about natural hygiene food combinations, forget about 80-10-10, eat, you know, the nutritarian diet has various foods mixed together in the food because the foods together act synergistically to protect our health.
Thank you.
Oh, sure. Dr. Furman, you're the best, and I wish we had more time because I could listen to you all day. So I guess I'm just going to have to go to your website, drfurman.com, and read all of your newsletters and listen to all your telecasts and take advantage of everything that's up there and read all your books like I have. But you're just loaded with just wonderful information that is so helpful and reassuring. So just keep doing what you're doing. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you, Karen. A pleasure being on your show, and all the best luck for everything you're doing. That's
thank
great.
You. Okay. Take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay. We're going to take a little break. That was Joel Furman, and I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. While we're on a break, you can go to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, where we have recipes and all of the podcasts from this show are archived up there, and there are food shows and videos. So visit. And now it's time for a break. We'll be right back. Hello, we're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food on this very lovely February 12th, 2013. And I want to remind you or let you know if you're just tuning in, I'm the founder of Responsible Eating and Living, a 501c3 not-for-profit, R-E-A-L, real. And we give you real truth and tools for health, wellness, and responsible green living. I really love food, and I love plant food, and I love talking about it. And wow, that last half hour with Dr. Joel Furman was amazing. You know he's my favorite doctor. I say that whenever I can. And all of his books are really wonderful. This most recent one, The End of Diabetes, I recommend a lot of books. Okay, this is like number one. It's fabulous. And I got into this because when I was young, I didn't want to kill animals. And then I realized how animals are so horribly treated in our food system. But the wonderful thing about eating plant foods, once you get into it and your taste buds kind of clean out from eating junk food and animal foods, and you find all these wonderful plant foods are so delicious, you find out that not only is this diet healthy for you, especially the way Dr. Furman recommends, but it's also the gentlest on the planet, and it's also kind, and we're not harming animals. And this is something to celebrate. And life is hard, And we don't always have things to celebrate. Here is something we can celebrate at every meal by what we choose to eat. And we can also celebrate by going to vegetarian food festivals. And that's what we're going to be talking about next. My guests are Sarah Gross and Neera Palawoda, who are the originators of the New York City Vegetarian Food Festival. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, how are you both doing? So we've got different coasts going on. Sarah, you're in New York?
I am.
And Neera, you're in California?
Yep.
Great. Well, I love technology, and I love how it can bring us all together from wherever we are. Okay, so is this the third festival? What year are we in?
This is the third.
Excellent. Good for you. And do we have some things to celebrate? When is it happening?
March 2nd and 3rd.
Okay, one at a time.
Talking over each other, sorry. Yeah, it's March 2nd and 3rd, just in a few short weeks, Saturday and Sunday at the Metropolitan Pavilion, which is where it was last year, and the address is 125 West 18th Street between 6th and 7th Avenue in New York. And, of course, we have things to celebrate.
Yeah.
And this year it's an even bigger event, so that's something to look forward to. Some of the things that we've done differently this year is that we've added another area for kids specifically. There's going to be a fun kids area where there's going to be some education over plant-based eating and also green living. So the kids get to interact.
That's great. Who's coordinating the kids section?
We have this wonderful woman named Robin Moore coordinating the kids area. She actually has a website about raising vegetarian kids, and she's just creating this amazing lineup of its own just for kids for the whole 2 days. So I wish I was a kid in New York right now.
Yeah, it can be hard for children, especially when parents are trying to raise them healthfully because they are inundated all the time intentionally by all kinds of marketing that isn't healthful for them. And kids just want to be like everybody else. So it's really important that they have support like this to know that they're doing the right thing and that there's other people that are doing
definitely, and it's fun, and it can be delicious, and just as great or better.
Right. Okay, so who shall we expect to see at this festival? Who are the speakers? What are they talking about?
So we have probably a very well-known figure is Jean Bauer, who's going to be coming to discuss the treatment of farm animals in our food system and the way we can just improve our world with the ethical choices that we make. We also have Matt Frazier, who's the no meat athlete, and so he's going to be talking a little more about the athletic side, but still connecting it with diet. We also have Adam Sobel of the Cinnamon Snail, which I don't know if many of your listeners know about, is the most popular vegan food truck, and I would say the best food truck, period. So he's the founder of that and the creator of so much delicious food, but his presentation is going to be called Pursuit of a Fully Nonviolent Lifestyle. So I'm really interested to see how that one is personally. He talks about reducing pollution caused by our lifestyles, which is also indirectly a form of violence against all beings on this planet besides what we are eating, too.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all breathe the same air. We all drink water. We all use the soil. We share this planet. And when some people use this planet as their toilet, without filtering and treating beforehand, we all lose.
Definitely.
Yeah. We're slowly connecting the dots when it comes to cigarette smoke and how people don't want to be breathing cigarette smoke. And it's taken over 50 years to reduce the smoking population by half. It takes a long time. But I'm hoping that in the next 50 years, thanks to things like vegetarian food festivals and other things, people connect the dots and realize how important not only food is, but lifestyle and our choices and their impact on everything around us. Good stuff. And what kind of food? Is there going to be food there?
It's definitely going to be food. So we have a whole variety. In the past, you know, a lot of people have seen more on the sweet side of the spectrum, and I'm happy to announce that we have a lot of savory this year. We have one company called De La Tierra, and they're bringing empanadas, tacos, burritos, vegan tuna sandwich, tofu stir fries, spicy seitan, all kinds of things. We have vegan marshmallows from Chicago Vegan Foods. We have hemp chocolates. We have a mushroom company, peanut butter, vegan seafood, Indian food, and it goes on and on.
Well, I think the point is that we can do just about everything with plant foods, and we're getting, every decade we get better and better. I want to say I'm so grateful for those vegan marshmallows. I don't eat them very often because they are a treat, and I believe in eating smartly most of the time, but occasionally we make s'mores, and when we do, those are the vegan marshmallows that we go for. We do have a s'more recipe on the Responsible Eating and Living website where we use those marshmallows, and I have a gluten-free vegan graham cracker recipe that goes with it, and it's really, it's too good.
We'll be looking that up then.
Yeah, it's too good.
Awesome.
Okay, well, you know, it's interesting because I think you're having more savory stuff this time, but I don't, I'm not up on the history of vegan cuisine, but I think we really did move more quickly in the dessert area than in the more main dish and savory things. Although right now we have everything, but I think we started with more desserts going vegan first, so probably why you had more sweets to begin with. But, you know, it's funny because people don't want to be deprived when they change their diet. They're afraid they're not going to be able to have all of their favorites, and their favorites usually include sweets.
Well, another thing, those are all true, but when it comes to a festival format, it's so much easier for companies who create, you know, baked goods, things that are already packaged, to come and make it happen rather than those who have, like, you know, to heat it up and prepare it on site. It's much harder just logistics-wise.
Right.
But we made a real big push to get more of them this year. And
well,
so we've got a lot of new foods.
That's really good to hear. You know, I know in New York City especially, it's true all around the country, but especially in New York City, we have some pretty strict health department rules when it comes to food preparation. I got my food certification certificate last year. I just wanted to go through it and see what all was involved. And it's pretty amazing all the rules that you have to adhere to when serving food. It's not easy.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you have to make sure, I mean, there's still foodborne illnesses and everything else, and when you're in a festival environment, when you're packaging so many things and handling, you know, quantities at a fast pace, you definitely have to make sure you're safe.
Now, I believe that vegan food probably has less of these foodborne illnesses connected to them. Unfortunately, some of the vegetables get a bad rap because they're fertilized with fertilizer that's already contaminated, and then, or they're handled with animal products that are already contaminated. The vegetables are innocent. They don't cause the problem.
Oh, definitely.
But you still have to be careful. Is there any entertainment at this festival?
We've got three whole stages of it.
What do we got?
We're never going to have an event of ours that is not going to have a portion of entertainment. So this year, like we said, we have the kids area. We have food demos. We have speakers, educational speakers, and then we have our stage that has a mishmash of different types of interactive activities for the adults and kids alike, such as yoga and boxing and
wow.
some fun, you know, more physical activities.
Yeah, it's
we
not
even have,
okay.
We even have a comedian this year, Mike Kaplan, who's going to be presenting a whole set. So it will be plenty entertaining.
Is it vegetarian material?
Well, he is a vegan, and I am sure for the festival he'll whip out a few vegetarian jokes.
Okay, that should be amusing. And,
This year we're also going to have a Saturday night music event. It's going to be a charity for benefiting Mercy for Animals. It's the official New York City Vegetarian Food Festival Saturday night after party at the Cutting Room.
Ooh.
So details of that are going to be announced within the upcoming week, but it is Saturday night from 7 to 10 at the Cutting Room in New York City.
I wanted to ask who the chefs are and what are they going to be making, do you know? At the food demos. People love watching food being made.
Right.
Yeah. One of our chefs is Christy Morgan. She's also known as the Blissful Chef.
Yeah, I interviewed her on this show. She's
yeah,
great.
She's pretty well known. Her presentation is called Quick Protein Pack Snacks for Everyone. And she's going to that's one demo. We also have a vegan cheese demo.
Miyoko Shinner.
Yes.
Is she coming? Oh, she's the best. Oh, have you ever made any of her recipes?
I haven't.
It's amazing. We've made the mozzarella, and it's amazing. I just can't believe it. I'm not a big cheese eater because I haven't eaten cheese in 25 years, but this is an incredible product. She's a genius.
We'll be happy to promote her. We also have Nava Atlas, and she's going to be having a segment called Wild About Greens.
Yeah, we've had her on the show, too.
Yeah.
And I love that book because it's the only cookbook I know that features my favorite foods, dark leafy green vegetables. So that'll be a great, great demo.
Definitely. And much more to come.
Okay, so the details. Where do we go to find out more about this?
Well, there's multiple places. Of course, our website, which is www.nycvegfoodfest.com. And also our Facebook, which is NYC Veg Food Fest. And definitely join Twitter as well, because we tend to, start promoting. Actually, we started promoting a little bit ago, but as it nears the festival, we'll start tweeting more exciting, upcoming events that are going to happen throughout the festival.
And is there a charge for this event?
We have VIP tickets available right now. If you go to the website or Facebook, there's a link. And there's one day and full weekend VIP tickets available. They're $30 per day or $50 for the weekend, and they also include 5 raffle tickets per day, depending on if you do this one day or the weekend. And then there's always going to be general admission available at the door on a first-come, first-served basis for $5.
Okay, but there's a long line there, so get early. Get there early.
Yeah, we recommend getting VIP tickets. It does, have you enjoy as much of the festival as possible. And like we said, it's on a first-come, first-served basis of letting people from general admission in. So VIP gets to avoid the line and walk straight in and enjoy the festivities inside.
And what about free samples? Are people going to get some freebies?
Absolutely. We encourage our vendors to get samples out, as well as some of them also do sell their products on site. So you could always taste what it is and then bring some back home with you. This year we actually have more vendors than last year as well, so a lot to choose from this year.
That's exciting. Can you tell us who some of the vendors are?
Yeah, we have a big list here. We have Pukka Herbs. It's a tea company from England. We have Beyond Sushi, a return favorite that just opened their storefront in the past year, vegan sushis. Cedars Mediterranean Foods, Coconut Bliss, the vegan ice creams. Fall Foods Worldwide, which is actually a new kind of vegan ice cream. Jayati, which is an Indian food company. Lismonade, which last year had a really big line for their really popular fresh lemonade blends. We have a lot of nonprofits. Mercy for Animals has a table. PETA, Sea Shepherd. And, of course, Rescue Chocolate will be there.
Oh, tell us about Rescue Chocolate, Sarah.
So Rescue Chocolate is my first company before the Veg Fest began. And all our profits go to animal rescue groups. And every chocolate bar flavor highlights a different rescue issue to do a little educating while you're eating chocolate.
And what have you learned about chocolate since you started this company?
I've learned that chocolate is much better when it's not hot outside.
It melts.
But also that it's something that I can never get tired of. I see and smell and handle this chocolate every single day, and I never get tired of it.
And you have to know that Sarah is one of these very lovely, slim folks. So just know she's got a chocolate company and wears it well.
Yeah, thank you. It's definitely in my daily diet.
Okay. Well, what else do we need to know about the New York City Vegetarian Food Festival before I let you two go?
Just come early. Enjoy. See as much as you can on all three of our stages. Enjoy the kind of after party we have planned on Saturday night and the other venue Nira was speaking about earlier. And bring all your friends.
Definitely sign on to the mailing list, because we do events outside of the New York City Vegetarian Food Festival throughout the year. So just because it happens once a year doesn't mean that we can't continue the fun throughout the year in different types of environments.
Okay, just one more question. You mentioned raffle tickets at the event. Do you know what some of the prizes are going to be?
Yeah, we have a good range of prizes. We've got actually blenders from KitchenAid. We have tote bags from the New Love, peanut butter from Saratoga Peanut Butter Company, Clean Plates books, Gristle Tattoo gift cards, DVDs from Vegan Mashup, all kinds of things.
Well, what's really wonderful is that so much has changed in the last decade when it comes to vegan food and vegan products, because, and especially in New York. There used to be a lot more in California, and I think Chicago and Brooklyn are really coming up fast with a lot of entrepreneurs that are doing wonderful products, and in a lot of other places, too. But we've seen tremendous change, tremendous variety, tremendous creativity, and you can sample some of that at this lovely festival.
And be sure to also know that kids 10 and under are free, and the event goes from 10 to 5 o'clock each day.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Sarah and Nira, and all the best of luck to you at the festival.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay. Bye-bye. I'm Karen Hartglass, and I wanted to tell you a little bit more about what's going on at my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living. And as you know, I have all of my It's All About Foods archived up at the website, but we started a really special project where we are transcribing all of these programs, and I have collected a group of wonderful volunteers who have been transcribing many of the programs. My goal is to get all of them done, and there's over 240 now maybe 250 of them. There are a lot. But I'm really excited about this project, and it's really been fun for me because when I proofread the transcriptions, I get to really experience the show again, whoever I was talking to, and I find them really interesting. I hope you do, too. And I think it'll be an interesting resource. You know, if there's something that you remember about a particular program but you don't want to listen to the whole thing again, well, then you can quickly scan the transcription and find whatever it is that you're looking for. Let me know what you think. My email is info@realmeals.org, and I love hearing from all of you. So I think that's it for today. It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and have a delicious week. Bye-bye.